shifters hope that you enjoy this rare and infamous moment that combines a first-rate disaster with genuine historical significance. But now it's time to take a deep breath and get those cameras out as we prepare to temporally reset you to one of the most fantastic catastrophes in history. Are you ready?
Everyone, and welcome back to the Time Shifters podcast. This is Christopher here with Tom in studio. That's awesome.
Yes.
Tom, how have you been?
Good. Yeah. I've watched a lot of terrible movies recently.
Yeah, check out some of our time hops that are surrounding this episode.
Indeed.
Yeah, that's about it. I've been watching a lot of screeners and stuff. I haven't had, I'm trying to think what else I've done and watched. I can't think of anything worth really mentioning. Oh. I mean, what's been going on with you?
Okay, other than screeners as well, other than I'm one shy of you, I'll let you carry on the task of handling that one. But no, the one thing that that I just burned your ear off earlier with was Netflix released a Three Body Problem in this past week, which it was a series obviously made from a book that I had never heard of or read, and I didn't know much about it going into it, and I saw that the internet was exploding with information and chose not to listen or read any of it because I just wanted to go in cold. Anytime somebody puts forth a solid sci-fi effort, I want to get at least give it a shot. I watched the first episode this recent Saturday and then tore through the rest of the 8 episodes in the same day.
That's says something right there.
Yeah, so this one caught me, and it hit all the right spots for me. It was dramatic. It was well thought out. It tried its best to use at least what we know of the science world to tell some of the story. It had lots of good stuff with lots of potential for the future, and I don't want to ruin anything for anyone, but I mean, I can't recommend it enough. I mean, the one thing that I will warn anyone of is it is a cerebral piece. This is sci-fi at its sci-fi-est. The idea is it's trying to... I'm not giving anything away. It does have an alien component to it. That's part of the story. But how they introduce them, where it's going to go, the fact that we don't actually even ever see them, which is a good component of this, just makes it so fascinating. It's really all about, one, the impending possibility of having this interaction with an alien race, but it's how we got to even talking to them. It's what is being done to people as they approach. It's just really riveting kind of stuff, but you have to hang a little bit with the intellect of it all.
Yeah, awesome. I actually read the book, the first book in this. It's a book of a trilogy.
Yes.
I read the first book, and I was really into the book at first. Mm-hmm. I found it to be, you said it's hard sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
I think it got a little too hard and a little too, you know, heady. And so I find myself kind of struggling to get through the last half of the book or whatever. But
yeah.
So I'm actually really curious to see it sort of in a visual form.
No, I'm just going to throw this out there, and I should have looked up the actress's name, but I was enamored. One of the main characters is played by the actress that played Keiko on Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Oh, right.
So yeah. It was fascinating to see her back and in the role that she was given. Obviously, she was much more of a side note in that series, and for her to take kind of a strong lead in what was going on in this series was a lot of fun, and it was fun to see the power that she kind of brought to her role. So it was very cool. And then the fact that it has a lot of, this story is being told by the same people that did Game of Thrones. Please don't do the same series ending that you did for Game of Thrones. Go in a better direction. But otherwise, I was so enthralled with the whole thing, and it was each episode, I had to see what happened next, and now I'm just mad because I ran through all 8 episodes, and I want to know what happens next.
Nice. That's an excellent. That alone is a good review.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, having read the book and mm-hmm. found myself struggling a little bit to get into it,
sure.
I'm curious to watch the actual
no,
series.
No, I
know that was a big deal. As soon as the book came out, there was people clamoring for a film or something like that. And so, yeah, Netflix is the one that came up and said, yeah, we'll make a series on that.
No, and it's fascinating how it even kind of unfolds. Like, from the beginning, you have to kind of work your way through the mystery. It involves something that much akin to a video game kind of scenario to vet people on whether or not they can go to a level where they're allowed to know what's going on. And then when you do know what's going on, it goes really wrong for right. a lot of people.
I was just reading real quick on Wiki. It does say that the three-body problem is loosely based on the Hugo Award-winning Chinese novel. So we'll see.
Well, see that now, since you have given the description of that first book being really a hard read, a hard to keep your attention.
Maybe they dumbed it down a little?
Dumbed it down a little, or maybe the fact that the visual component may actually, in this case, add. This might be one of those scenarios where visual may trump read.
Yeah, maybe just make it a little bit more accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, still very interesting. I'm curious. I'm glad you reminded me that it was even coming out. I knew it was happening. I didn't know exactly when. Apparently, it just happened.
Like literally last week.
A week before recording or so. Record. Yeah. So just within the last month. So awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely look for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't been doing a whole hell of a lot. My wife and I, just because, started kind of binging the old I don't even know if it was BBC or not. It was the British comedy, Are You Being Served?
Oh, okay. Wow.
We just started binging that for some reason. And it's still pretty damn funny.
Well, yeah, other than that, I also made my way finally through the last of Grand Tour to catch the sand job.
Right.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed with that one. I thought it felt way too scripted.
Well, and that's kind of been the complaint with this latter portion of Grand Tour anyways. It seems a bit forced, and it actually starts... well, not forced. They're very natural at doing it. I had a great time watching it, but it was easily... Okay, you didn't happen across these things. You were never in really any real danger...
That wasn't a minefield.
Yeah, there was no minefield in there. They weren't going to be. The fascinating part was literally having an actual uprising in the city that they were supposed to fly out of, just as they were supposed to arrive at it. So that actually was compelling, but it made me think at the end of the episode, because literally they say, in order for us to literally leave Africa, we have to drive all the way back to where we started. And even if they hadn't done more episode to get to that, it would have been nice to even see during the final credit sequence them making their way back.
Right.
I think that would have at least uplifted the episode a little bit more.
I think the best part, the thing I found probably the most humorous, was when they find that really big, long tunnel, and they're like, and Jeremy and Hammond... I was trying to think the short one, the hamster.
Hamster.
I had to go hamster before I could get to Hammond. We're joking. He's like, you know what we could do here? We could drive really fast, see how fast we can drive through the tunnel. And May's like, yeah, I'm not doing that.
No, that was a nice little callback to literally the last episode where May damn near killed himself.
Yeah.
But no. And here's the thing. I gave it a little more room than maybe you did, because these guys are getting too old to do this thing.
No, I get that. I get that. And that's fine. It's just when they come to outside the tunnel and it's all this, you know, doing an inner minefield everywhere.
That was too far. I mean, that doesn't capture.
That's not a real thing. And then the truck blows through. And,
yeah.
You know, none of that's real. It's not funny.
No, no. And then the gags that they pull on each other are now starting to see way too overstaged and overdramatic. I mean, filling May's car with sand.
Yeah.
And then making him dig it out. I'm like, okay, well, you clearly planned that, and clearly he knew that was going to happen to him, because there was not an emotional reaction like, you have just ruined my next 2 days.
Right.
So, yeah, it has a bit of that. So that part's a little disappointing. They'll never recapture, like, Death Road in Belize and all that.
Yeah.
That was truly like, I actually kind of believe that they could have gone over the side at any moment.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure Jeremy had to change his shorts.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, too. Yeah. So... recapturing that, you also have to remember at this stage, and it's really kind of no joke, it's like 15, 20 years ago that episode took place.
Right.
And it's hard to even think of that, especially in the world of streaming now, where you can just consume it all straight through, and you're not seeing that, but you're watching the angst fall apart a little bit because it's overscripted.
Yeah, these are not the guys that are going to be driving to the North Pole.
No, you know, no.
Or driving up the side of a volcano to get the newest Earth possible.
No, and while it was fun, and they aren't even doing their own modifications anymore. I truly believed at one point they were part of that. Now I think they just kind of go, let's spitball with the team that's actually going to do that.
Sure.
But so that part gets a little tiresome too. But the funny thing is, they started off the episode showing you real cars that were designed to do what they were going to do.
And I thought,
I kind of wanted to see them do it.
I thought that's what they were going
to
do.
That Lamborghini, I wanted to see that Lamborghini.
Yeah, I wanted to see those three cars that they introduced. I thought, oh, well, these are the cars that we're going to see through the whole show. No.
And you would go, okay, well, they didn't do that because of the price of the cars. But when you consider what it cost them to do the rest of it, the price of the car was probably a drop in the bucket. Especially a $2 million Lamborghini. I'm under the impression we might get one or two more before the Grand Tour is completely done.
They're under contract to do at least one more.
Already
been done. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a matter of when it gets released. But I have a hard time thinking they're not going to go out with a little bit more fanfare, because this didn't have, like they even said at the end of the episode, we'll be back. Mm-hmm. So I have a hard time seeing them just cut it off right there. I think Amazon will at least do one more good one, but we'll have to see.
I just know Amazon went from really promoting the show to now, if you don't go hunting for it, you don't know it's there.
kind of, and we have Jeremy to thank for that.
Yeah. And apparently, and I don't know if it's going to show up in the U.S. anywhere, but he's continuing to do Clarkson's Farm.
Right.
There's been two seasons released here in the States. I saw a thing on Facebook where he was promoting season 4.
Right, and we haven't seen season 3.
I don't know anything about season 3, so...
Right. Well, Amazon's Amazon. It'll show up sometime. He may just been contracted and promoting the fact that they get to carry on through 4.
And I think I've said before on the show, it's a shame that Clarkson has done what he's done to himself, because Clarkson's Farm is actually a show I think everyone should watch, because he does a really great job of highlighting the trials and tribulations of a farmer, whether it be a farmer in the UK or a farmer in the US or a farmer anywhere in the world.
It's also fascinating when watching that series to see him kind of back out of some of the things that he has always thought over his career. So the whole "there's no such thing as climate change" thing. Actually, acting as a farmer, he's now on board. That's a thing. It's a real thing.
No, that show and that experience, I think, that has legitimately kind of humbled him a little bit.
Well, yeah, because I believe he's owned that farm for a good long time, but it wasn't till the show till he had to work it. There was one thing between owning it and actually working it. Yeah. He is getting an impression, and what's great about that is, since he is the doddering old idiot that he has a tendency to be. Watching him try to do that, even when we know a bit of it's staged, he's not doing literally everything that they're suggesting he's doing. But even if he's just doing some of it and gaining an appreciation of it, and you, the audience, who is not a farmer, you get to live that through him and actually start to understand the costs of actually running a farm,
yeah.
The sheer volume of work, the chaotic nature of trying to deal with Mother Nature while you also try to feed the world. Yeah, yes. There's a lot more on your shoulders to be a farmer than I think we all have an appreciation for.
And he even adds that complicates it by not only being a farmer, but also trying to be a businessman with his diddly squat market, this farmer's market, and fighting with the local town. And
which, again, probably wouldn't be quite the pain if he weren't a royal pain in the ass.
Yes, if in the past he hadn't actually terrorized them at several times and completely demolished his house with a giant explosion and other such things.
Yeah, so one would hope that at some point this is all a large dose of humility for him, but the part where it will always take the edge off is the sheer volume of money he's making to do this on our behalf. So
yeah,
you got to take it a little grain of salt.
Yeah. And with a lot of shows, the reason to watch isn't necessarily the star.
Right.
The cast of characters that they got that and he they surrounds are characters, himself with.
I actually watching, even in social media, watching Caleb become more of a thing.
Yeah.
It's just too much fun because, I mean, this was a guy that was just destined to be a farmhand
right.
all of his life, and his life is changing dramatically
now. Yeah, now he's going to London for premieres and tuxedos and...
People are naming sandwiches after him. Yeah. It's just it's a lot of fun. It's worth a watch, and it will teach you a little bit more about the world of farming in an entertaining way.
Yeah, like absolutely.
Right down to even the one that I was always enamored with, because I've only made it through the first season. I haven't watched second yet, but the animal husbandry part, the he's made the mistake of actually becoming affectionate toward his flock, and then knowing what has to happen to him the first time he actually has to go with it. Dramatization or not, I think he actually felt all of that when, like, oh, wait, I raised all these, and now I'm going to have them killed.
Yes.
So, yeah, no, it teaches you the full aspect of all of it, so it's so much, it's a lot of fun.
It is, yep.
And then there's a Lamborghini tractor.
Yes, of course.
Because
that's where they got their start.
I know, that's where the bull comes from on right. their badge.
The farm equipment is where Lamborghini, that's their humble beginnings.
Literally had that conversation with my son on the drive out here. I had him literally Googling which came first, the tractor or the supercar. So he was having a lot of fun with that. So yeah, great show. Give it a shot.
Yeah. So yeah, I think, you know, let's go ahead and we'll listen to a promo for another show. And when we get back, we're going to talk about 2014's RoboCop.
Okay, you know what it's like. You're flicking through Amazon or the local DVD shop, when suddenly you discover a film that you haven't seen in years, but which you remember as being legendary. The purchase is hastily made, you invite friends over, make popcorn, and settle down to watch this classic. But then it becomes apparent that your mind has double-crossed you, and that this film is frankly awful. Soon your friends have deserted you, your boss says he has to let you go, and even your dog won't come when you call. How did it go so wrong? Well, in the interests of public harmony, a new podcast, I Saw That Years Ago, sets out to watch the old films that your memory has convinced you are brilliant, but which in reality could be anything but. So join me, your host Martin Darkley, and my compatriot, Gentleman Joe, as we watch the old films so you don't have to. Find us at www.isawthatyearsago.com or on iTunes.
What if I told you that even the worst neighborhood in America could be made completely safe? How do I know this? Because it's happening right now in every country in the world but this one. It is great to see American machines helping to promote peace abroad. So then tell me, why can't we use these machines here at home? Why is America so robophobic?
We need to give Americans a product they can love, a figure they can rally behind.
We can't put a machine on the street.
Forget machines. They want a product with a conscience. Something that knows what it feels like to be human.
Give your mom a kiss.
Bye, baby.
Too slow, boy.
We're gonna put a man inside a machine.
Time to wake him up.
Make him more tactical.
Let's go with black.
Quality control, EM-208 versus Tin Man.
Wow. We are going to make a lot of money.
He's coming.
Don't play good cop, bad cop.
Bad cop, RoboCop.
He's undoing what we did to him.
Shut it down!
Thank you for your cooperation.
...2014's RoboCop is obviously a remake of the 1987... I don't know, would you call it a cult classic or just a classic?
Cult classic's probably a little more accurate.
Yes.
This isn't for everyone.
Yeah. It is directed by Jose Padilla and written by Joshua Zetimer, Edward Neumer, and Michael Miner. Starring Joel Kinnaman, Gary Oldman, Michael Keaton, Abby Cornish, with Jackie Earle Haley and Samuel L. Jackson. In 2028, all over the world, a robotic police patrols the city streets, everywhere but in the United States, where they have been outlawed by the Dreyfus Act. Developer Omnicorp, led by Raymond Sellers, is desperate to get into the American market. All efforts to sway the congressmen and the general public have continued to fail. In an effort to circumvent the law, he and his lead scientist, Dr. Dennett Norton, decide to put a man into the machine and create a cyborg. Meanwhile, Detective Alex Murphy is working on exposing a gun-running gang boss, Antoine Vallon, and the cops that are on his payroll. When they decide that he's getting too close, they attempt to kill him with a car bomb, burning over 80% of his body and costing him a leg and an eye. Murphy becomes the perfect candidate for Omnicorp's cyborg experiment. Now, this was a first-time watch for me.
Really?
I've watched the original RoboCop.
Of course.
A couple times, yeah. But it's been a long time. And this actually really got me eager to go back and watch the original.
Oh, yeah, because I actually watched this one with my son. This was his first watch, but I saw this one in the theater. And I kept getting tickled whenever they would at least pay homage to the original, because they actually even... worked in the phrase "I'll buy that for a dollar" at one point.
They changed it a little bit. James Earl Haley is the one. He's the kind of guy that is really against the whole RoboCop idea.
Yep.
And he's pointing out all the flaws. And he's like, "I wouldn't buy that for a dollar."
Yeah. But I was very tickled when that particular phrase came up.
They did a lot of homages to it. The original appearance of RoboCop is very reminiscent of the 87.
Not just reminiscent, but when they were, I don't know if you caught it, while they were cycling final finishes for him, there is an armored RoboCop, and then it's the dead, it's a dead ringer for the original RoboCop.
And I think there was even a static suit in Sellers' office that in the back looked like it was probably the original RoboCop. The music was there. Yep. The RoboCop music actually it's actually the theme song of the film, and it is played, you know, at a couple times within the film.
Yep.
So you have X amount of seconds to comply. That's in there.
Yeah, they managed to work in Dead or Alive, You're Coming With Me.
Yes.
Right down to the sounds of his body when he's in his RoboCop armor. The motions where he tends to move in right angles.
Yeah.
And the clomp of the foot and the very robotic and the hum sounds that you hear when his body moves. I'm like, that was very dead on.
No, oh, absolutely. So yeah, you actually saw us in the theater. Have you watched it?
A couple of times.
A couple of times since.
Yeah. No. I realized this one, it sits in a weird spot for people. But I actually find that I really enjoy this one. In fact, I would go as far as to say that this movie is hindered by the original RoboCop.
Mm.
I think this one kind of surpasses the original RoboCop. The original one is very campy, and it's intended to be so. And it, being an 80s action film, it has all of those moments. But this one had the original RoboCop had things to say about society and all that, and if anything, probably projected Detroit's future a little bit better than this one did. But to that point, this had more commentary on the world that we live in now than the original one did back in its day.
I remember I read that people asked Paul Verhoeven what he thought of this remake.
Yeah.
And apparently he watched it, and he felt that it was just another poor remake of one of his films, and it lacked kind of the fun and the spirit of the original film. And I, in a way, I kind of agree. Where I'm not necessarily saying that it has to have that camp factor.
Yeah,
I personally did feel that this one just lacked a little bit of. It definitely lacked a little bit of fun, and I think it lacked.
It was a far more serious film.
Yeah, and it lacked a little bit of heart. I think I wasn't connecting with it.
No, I get that, but I think it wanted to live more in the social commentary, which might have hindered it a bit. Again, it's still an action movie about a robotic police officer. You want something, and it still delivers on the action. There is no shortage of action in this film.
Almost to, I think, its detriment.
Possibly.
I got a little... I mean, it's a almost 2-hour long film.
Yes.
And, you know, we have to watch like 5 minutes of what feels like video game footage while he's going through his training and things like that.
No, but see, what I took away from those is as they were teasing out what they wanted their RoboCop to be. Like, when he first wakes up and he has his body and all that, he is still very much him. He is Murphy. I actually enjoyed watching the corporation go, him being Murphy's not really going to work for us, especially when they put him through the first trials of right next to one of the robots of going through the little trial thing, and his reaction is slower and it's more human. And they're trying to strike that balance between giving the human aspect so the populace will latch onto this, but give him the efficiency of the robot, and there's that struggle between the two. I actually kind of dug that more cerebral sense to it all, so I gave it a little more leeway on that part.
I like that. I think they could have done it differently.
Possibly.
One of the things that I think that the original film, I think, got right is right from the start, they build RoboCop, and he is kind of an emotionless, he doesn't know, he's just RoboCop.
Yeah.
And it's things that happen to him that spark his memories and allows him to override what they've done to him and everything. And that's a real big, you know, a big cathartic moment for the character.
Sure.
And in this film, you know, he starts out, he's human and he's torn because, you know, his body's gone and everything. Mm-hmm. I get it. And then they do this thing to him. And then slowly, yeah, he overrides it and everything. But I almost wish they had just started out a little bit more like the original and just said, well, we couldn't just let him because he'd be too shocked. So we put this programming in, and so he thinks he's doing it, but it's really the computer. And just do that right from the get-go and cut out those 20 minutes of us having to be explained why they're doing it and what they're going to do and et cetera, et cetera.
I get that point of view, and yeah, that would speed up the film a tad, but I actually like that whole notion of they didn't really know what was going to come of this particular fusion, so they went with what they thought was right, and then when it doesn't give them the result that they want, now they dial it in a completely different way. So I even liked that notion, and it does bring up a philosophical bent. If you were to move us in a cybernetic fashion, what is that line? What is that line between you being the man and the machine? And I love that little notion that when we get to the second trial where they're going to prove, yeah, we can dial him up to what the robot is capable of. That notion that they also managed to figure out how to make him think he was making choice. I get very soft on the whole. I love when we bring in the metaphysical, the where is our line in this world? Where, how do we even know what we think now is our own thought? I like when you explore that. Granted, is this the vehicle for that? I don't know, but I liked it.
They do that, and they do the programming, and so they explain that the computer's controlling him, but he thinks that it's him.
Yeah.
But we never get it from his side.
Right. And
there's at no point where he's like, oh, this is fantastic. Did you see what I did? Nothing. It just, that scene, that whole training thing stops and something else picks up.
Right. No, because after this point, we're ready to ship him home. And this is where I will give the movie a solid knock. What was the thought process by literally downloading every criminal file for Detroit into his brain 5 minutes before he was supposed to meet the public?
Right.
Like, wait, wouldn't you have done that when you had a little more time to do it and when you knew what might happen? Because you're now asking the human brain to absorb an entire computer database.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, by the way, did we not mention we're including the footage of his own death?
Right.
So what might that do to him when he hit? So I like that they built the meltdown. The timing just didn't seem right for the movie.
No, absolutely not.
I liked it, kind of what they tried to get out of it, but it made, like, there's no logical sense to why you would do that then.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that they wanted to go, okay, this has driven him completely insane, and we have to turn him almost all machine to basically make him RoboCop 1.
Mm-hmm.
That would make sense, but doing it in the moment that they chose to do it was weird.
Before that, they... when they first create him, he's in the silver, very reminiscent mm-hmm. of 87 RoboCop and everything.
Yeah.
And then at some point, Sellers, played by Michael Keaton, by the way, who was fantastic.
He was.
He says, oh, make him more tactical, you know, maybe black and everything.
Yeah.
I actually think that was a bad choice.
It was a terrible choice.
I think I understand why they did it from a filmmaker kind of point of view, because now they don't have to CG as much.
Right, yeah.
You can
fake it a little.
It's just a guy in a suit, and that's the problem. It just looks like a guy in a fancy tactical suit.
Right.
And it's like, well, he's not RoboCop anymore. He's guy in a cool tactical suit.
Right, no. No, that and not to mention, since you're trying to warm over the public, making him look like a black killing death machine like the other robots might not be the branding you're going for, which is why in the end when all is well again and all that, and he's been given a new body, he is back to that that steel blue look,
right,
with black inset, mm-hmm, which does actually look way better anyway.
Yeah, no, it actually looks very cool. One thing I did like, in the first film, all they gave him was like some crappy Ford,
right,
to drive
yeah,
around
yeah, he
in.
Was driving everybody else's police car.
Yeah. This one, they gave him a really sweet motorcycle.
They did.
The modified, I think it was some sort of modified Kawasaki, if I'm not mistaken.
Built to purpose, too. The way he even rides on it, mm-hmm, he just mm-hmm essentially fuses to the frame when he gets on it.
I think I read that this bike can actually do like 225 miles an hour.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that looked, and him riding it with, you know, the
with
red,
his visor,
the red
and the
visor,
red,
and yeah, the bike had like blue and red, you know, lights, police lights.
Oh yeah,
lights,
no, they're like, run inset on the front of the bike, and then he's got his legs fully swept back. They aren't actually doing any control on the bike.
Right,
he is fused to the bike. It's whatever his body is commanding the bike to do is what that bike is doing.
As someone that's just recently watched all 13 episodes of the old Street Hawk, I'm thinking, this is what that was supposed to be. and it so wasn't.
I see why this is living in your brain that way now. Yeah. It also seemed like a bike that if you weren't built out of metal, you were going to die.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I think that is definitely a death machine for anyone not RoboCop.
Yep.
Yeah, but for me, it's just, like I said, I just found myself having a hard time connecting. I don't know. Joel Kinnaman is not someone I was familiar with. I think this is the first time I've seen him in anything. He sounds the part.
Yeah.
I think he gives the RoboCop lines really yeah well. His appearance just doesn't work for me.
Really?
There's something about, especially when he's in the black outfit with the tight helmet and yeah everything. It's just, he doesn't look right.
Really? Yeah. Well, one, I figured they wanted him almost entirely for his actual build. So when they actually put a costume on him, it still looks like it belongs as part of his body. Mm. So I credit to that. I think I've seen him in a few other things. And since I'm in studio and don't have access to much, I'd look up. But I recognize him from some other pieces. I like him fine in the role, and the fact that this RoboCop had to keep toggling between being very human and then being very robot, I actually found him rather successful. The only problem I would grant you is he was already a little wooden with his family. It was a little weird. Like, before he was RoboCop, their dynamic in the home was a little off. He didn't seem to have much chemistry with his wife, despite the fact that he was supposed to have a lot of chemistry with his wife.
Right.
And he seemed like he almost scared his son, even when he was just cop dad, before he was RoboCop. So, and then, actually, the family dynamic is the thing that probably detracts the most for me from the movie, because even going in this, I liked that they went in the, he's human, the family's actually involved in the decision that he becomes RoboCop,
mm-hmm,
and that their expectation is his will be back in their life in some capacity. It'll be radically different, and they understand that, maybe not to the full extent of that, but at least they'll have their husband and father back. And that reintroduction to the family, while he still has his full emotional range, still didn't kind of sit right. I get why they might be apprehensive, but he seemed almost too apprehensive about the whole thing. And something about that was a little off-putting. So those are the spots where you feel like the movie takes a speed bump.
Maybe. And I think, if I remember right, in the first one, Alex Murphy had a family.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were just told that he died.
Yeah.
And so his memory of his family comes back later yeah in the film, but even he doesn't actually confront them because of what he has become.
Yeah, no, he makes that decision in the film.
And there's even a line from Sellers. He's actually trying to talk BS at the moment to try sure to justify having him destroyed, RoboCop destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what have we done to him? What life could he possibly have? And
right.
thinking, yeah, that's true, actually. You know, I know why you're saying it.
Right.
And you're not being sincere, but that's true.
Right, yeah.
What have you done? What in the world could you could this guy possibly feel like he could contribute to his family in this form?
Right. No, which is why Michael Keaton was amazing in that. And the writing was very good for that. They gave him enough reel to hang his bullshit on.
Yes.
And you're like, this feels familiar. This feels like something we get out of corporate world every day.
Yeah. I tell you what really kind of raises the bar in this film for me is the addition of Gary Oldman.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one of those actors where if you put him in your movie, you get a little extra something for it.
You get a little bump there.
And I think he was brilliant as the scientist who is seen, oh, this is how I'm going to make my, you know, this is it. I'm going to be proven right. And mm-hmm. all my theories and all my experiments, this is awesome. And then finding, this was a mistake. Yeah. I understand that now. And he does it so well because he becomes very sympathetic to Alex Murphy.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, he's at the cusp of like, I'm going to destroy my life now by helping you.
Right.
But he knows it's the right thing to do because he realizes, I should have never done this. Well, it's a little bit like it's watching like Frankenstein, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's it, at its heart what RoboCop
absolutely.
Is. It's a retelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The thing that, again, where Gary Oldman brings just his gravitas to it is when you're at that, you're getting to the end of the climax of the movie, and he's having a conversation with Sellers where Sellers is basically telling him, you're going to do this or, and then I'll give you everything you want. And as he's considering it, you actually watch his character lay out his demands. Okay. I'll do what you ask. And here's everything that you're going to do to make me happy in this decision. And he even had me believing, like, I remember distinctly in seeing it in the theater, so not the very first time I'm watching it, like, this is a spot where we could actually see him go in that direction, like, legitimately mm-hmm. justified, because he was very much into all of his work with
paraplegics, amputees,
and the prosthetics. That's the word I was looking for. The prosthetics that he was developing and the intricacy of them all. And you could see him going, yeah, I made this Frankenstein mistake, and now I have an opportunity to go do the right thing. And is it worth a single life to do it? I could have bought that literally was about to be what happened. So watching him have his better angels even come out of bed, I'm like, that even felt even better when he did it.
Yeah. 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 He was brilliant. I mentioned Jackie Earle Haley earlier. Mm-hmm. He was a drone controller. And,
yeah. He was the henchman. He was the head guy.
I don't know exactly what his role in the OmniCorp company was, except I think he sort of, oversaw the, how the robots work. I guess he sort of, in a way, trained the robots.
Yeah, no, I think he was the tactician in the the field with the he would run the drones. He'd monitor the drones, make sure that they were on mission and all that stuff. So
I liked his character. I liked that there was a character in there that was like, robots are tools, people are people. There is no crossing between, you know, in between. There's nothing in between.
Yeah,
and so he had a real prejudice against the whole idea of RoboCop, and he was doing everything in his power to discredit the idea.
What's fascinating about his particular character is while his approach had that really hard-edged, smarmy, a-hole feel to it, he wasn't wrong.
No.
Ultimately, he was the bad guy that had it right. Now, he was prepared to do all the horrible things that went along with what he was trying to do. And then you have to get into the whole, what OmniCorp was doing with their robot army to begin with.
Right.
That's a whole other conversation. But despite all of that, his head is kind of in the right place with what has just happened with the RoboCop program.
And the RoboCop, well, not the RoboCop program, but the robots all over the country patrolling the cities and keeping us quote-unquote safe is a conversation that was had by Pat Novak in this film, played by Samuel L. Jackson as sort of a loudmouth news host. I don't know exactly how to pigeonhole him.
And we kind of talked this a little bit beforehand. Sam Jackson loves to play the counter to who he is. And I think he was channeling his inner Hannity. he really kind of wanted to have that. I'm going to have a very apologize, but it is going to be a very hardcore right-wing stance on this whole thing. It's American power. We're going to do what we say, wherever we say. And as a slight correction to what you were talking about, these robots were only abroad. Only abroad. So they're not in American cities. They're in... And that's the opening sequence as we get the Novak show as they're live in Iran laying down the law that I don't know that we should be laying down.
Right.
But this is where we can even start getting into those parallels. How did they get it right? And the notion of our persistent presence in places where maybe we shouldn't be, but how we go about doing it. Well, we don't have robots. Drone attacks and that whole mechanical mission thing is very much a part of our life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think I took much. I went to try to take notes as I always do when I'm watching the film and trying to pick out, you know, technology or facts or events that, and there, honestly, I didn't find a whole much at first. I thought, oh, you know, the whole Pat Novak and he's in the sort of, green screen studio.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, well, that's actually very CNN these days. No. And all the networks
that whole
are
move
doing
around.
It.
I mean, think about whenever we go through an election and they have the big screens and they're literally moving around in the stage. I mean, that's that's spot on.
They do those
kind of things.
There was one line in this film that I audibly chuckled at.
Yeah.
It was in a discussion with Sellers and some of his little cronies and everything, and they were trying, you know, talking about, you know, trying to get this Dreyfus Act overturned and everything. And one of his people said that the senators, you know, they've bought all the, they've tried to buy the senators and everything. They've got money going into their pockets and everything, but the senators don't want to vote against their constituents.
Yeah, no, I
like, no one believed that in 2014. They definitely aren't going to believe that in 2028.
No, that hasn't been real maybe ever.
No. Yeah. If that's ever been real, it hasn't been real in a long, long time.
No, in fact, OmniCorp probably would have had every say in all of that rather than the constituents. But
yeah,
nice try. I guess they were trying to go for a little more upbeat note on that. But technologically, other stuff, I like that they kept it kind of realistic, especially since this is a 2014 movie and it's only 14 years in the future. They didn't stretch it too far, but while in 2028, with only 4 years to go, we aren't going to be robots and all that, but the amount of AI coming up, the amount of actual robotic and humanoid robots coming up, that is starting to become a thing. They're not far off. They kept other tech pretty reasonable otherwise.
And honestly, some of the prosthetics that they were showing aren't all that far off.
No,
I mean, I'd say within the next decade, we might see someone playing a guitar with prosthetic hands.
Maybe not quite that well, but...
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know, the next 10, 15 years. And there has been a lot of work about melding mechanics with the human nervous system.
Yep.
So you can have a hand that you think and it moves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is something that is actively being done and being worked on and experimented with today. And in maybe not by 2028,
right?
But maybe 2038. I mean, that is something that I think will come to pass.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, kudos to them for some of that stuff. They're probably not far off. And honestly, I know that they were an homage to the original, the giant tank-like robots. I forget what the acronym
is. Is it the Ed 209?
Yeah, the Ed. That sounds right. Ed 209. That sounds right. I mean, we don't make those, but
we could
make those. Those don't seem that complicated in today's world. So the fact that we don't have them is just a act of the fact that they're terrifying. But I wouldn't put it past that there's not something on a military drawing somewhere that says we might build that someday.
Yeah. I did like, and just kind of going back a little bit, and we somewhat tied in because we talked about the, you know, senators and everything. And there was the one scene when Sellers was being questioned by Congress and by Senator Dreyfus, who the act was named for and everything. And that's actually a really nice scene and a really good kind of back and forth between the two, because Dreyfus is asking, you know, what would the robot feel? Mm-hmm. And Sellers tries to spin it and, you know, it's like, you're not answering, you're evading the question.
Right.
If it shot a child, what would it feel? And Sellers has to admit, it wouldn't feel anything.
Right.
And Dreyfus is like, and that's my point. And that's the end of the scene. I'm like, oh, that's good. I mean, that's the... I want Dreyfus for president.
Kind of. And actually, when you watch enough C-SPAN, you can catch occasionally a version of that. It's just not with people that are likely to become president anytime soon.
No. Yeah. But I did like that that scene didn't really need to be there other than it just sort of hammered home why the Dreyfus Act was a thing and why someone like Omnicorp wanted them to repeal it.
Right.
Why it was this brick wall for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I just really thought that was a nice scene.
No, that was an amazing, but of course it also sets up the premise for why they have to do this, and that's where
we
lead into the conversation. Well, what if we put a man in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it just occurred to me. I don't know why I didn't think of this when I was talking about when they had him in the suit and the RoboCop suit and everything. One of the things I really liked about the original RoboCop, the design, the makeup design, his face looked like it was plastered over robotic parts.
Right.
In this, it looks like a helmet wrapped around his face. And that takes me out of the idea that, oh, that's not a robot. That's a guy in a suit.
Right.
I, having the face look like it's pinned on, I think worked better.
I like the pinned on face thing, the skin stretched over. But given their objective of having it be... That was the thing. The man in the suit, that they actually wanted it to look like a man in the suit. To
right,
give it
I
that more
so.
Human
good
feel.
Good point. Yeah.
So that was it. But I'm going to just take this moment because one of the effects that still is all... you can't not be taken aback by the scene is when Gary Oldman's character strips all of the hardware away from Murphy, and he sees all that is actually left of him.
Yeah, lungs and a heart. And
how his brain didn't explode on the spot from just the sheer terror of seeing this is all that I am. And I mean, it was accurate that he was just saying, kill me now, kill me now. But this is where maybe a different actor might have been better. I needed to feel more that kill me now. He did not, he wasn't conveying the panic that I think anybody in that situation, especially seeing their bare lung laid open in glass, their brain exposed.
Right.
And the only hand that they can feel with is literally not attached to their body. I'm like, that should have had even more impact for that actor. And I think they did, as cool as the scene was, that emotional range needed to be ramped up a lot higher than it was.
Yeah, no, but I agree.
A lot of fun to watch.
Yeah,
kudos to the effects team. That was amazing.
Yeah, it did actually look really good. They did a nice job with that. I did throw this out to social media. Unfortunately, I only got a couple real short comments. I did not get much from it. Justin over on Facebook says it's one of the few remakes that I can stomach. It's glorious. So nice. He's a big fan.
Nice.
And let's see, over on Blue Sky, Clovar says it was way better than RoboCop 3. not a high bar to overcome.
No. No, not at all.
But I appreciate the comment, and, you know, I agree with your sentiment. I will agree with that, even though this is not going to go up in the list of, like, favorite films that we've watched or anything.
Yeah.
It is better than RoboCop 3. I will grant you that.
Yeah. Oh, as for films for me, I thoroughly enjoy this, but it's not a favorite. I don't seek it out. But if it's on, or if, hey, I haven't seen that in a while, I will definitely rewatch.
All right, sweet.
So from The Professionals.
Yeah, what the critics have to think.
They were really all over the map on this. So I got lots of good stuff from this. So starting more at the top, per usual, from San Francisco Chronicle, Mike LaSalle. He writes, RoboCop is no canned remake of the 1987 action film. It's a reimagining that responds to everything that has changed in American life over the past 27 years, addressing new threats and exploiting new anxieties. It's not a somber movie, but it's dead serious in its intent, using fantasy to present audiences with a cautionary glimpse of where modern life may be heading. This time, everything is at stake and everything is thrown into the pot. The movie is implicit commentary about the use of drones, about the nature and future of being human, and about proper role of the United States in the world. So he took this at everything that it was throwing at him.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we have from New York Post to Kyle Smith. The 1987 RoboCop was a good movie if you like bad movies. And who doesn't?
You know what? That's a really great way. I never thought about that. There's so many films I watch that I think I would say the exact same thing. Oh, it was a good movie if you like bad movies.
Right. And he even goes, and who doesn't?
Yeah.
The remake is something quite different. Thoughtful, grounded, more interested in questions of free will and emotions versus technology than it is in goofy satire. You know you're not in Paul Verhoeven land anymore when our introduction to bionic fingers is watching them master classical guitar instead of lifting a guy by his Adam's apple.
Mm-hmm.
RoboCop is topically up to the moment, but stylistically, it's retro. Far from using the story as an excuse to string together cheap thrills and blowout spectacles, its hero has all the heart of the Tin Man. So
interesting.
Interesting take, maybe a little too Heidi, but I like where his head's at.
Yeah, absolutely.
From NPR, we have Ian Buckwalter. This is when we're starting to move to the middle. It's well-made, polished, and hits every mark, but it's crazy to want a futuristic sci-fi action flick about a motorcycle-riding metal super cop to be just a little more fun. And so he's taking more your side of this. Not that you hated it, but you wanted a little fun re-entered into it.
I think, you know, it just occurred to me, you know, we got the motorcycle riding super cop and everything. We didn't really see him doing the super cop thing much.
Not
much.
We
saw him buzzing around on the bike, and we hear about him, you know, reducing crime in Detroit. But it's like, where was that montage?
Yeah,
of all these 2 hours, I could have done without one or two training session and had a crime-busting montage.
Yeah, we didn't. Well, because the 87 one, that's what you lived for, is that almost that montage where he's just doing standard cop stuff throughout Detroit. We only get the super, super cop part right at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So then we get to, now we're moving into the darker side. So Boston Globe, Ty Burr, best he could do was, the film doesn't embrace itself or dishonor its predecessor, which is something.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And then finally out of our RogerEbert.com, this would be Glenn Kenny that wrote this. Just to make it clear, in the event that my low rating for this movie, and he did give it one star.
Ooh, ow.
Yeah, that was maybe a bit harsh. But in the event that my low rating for this movie gives you the immediate impression that I'm some kind of aggravated fanboy or hardcore Paul Verhoeven auteurist or something, cinematic sacrilege is the least of this RoboCop remake's sins. No, the main thing wrong with RoboCop is that it's dumb and it's trashy, and it's both those things in a not good way. And it tries to cover its dumb trashiness with a veneer of exciting, quote unquote, visuals and production value. And also the fact that its producers hired a group of very talented actors to inject some very talented actor juice into their dumb, trashy concoction.
Wow.
Really, really harsh.
Wow.
Not what I was expecting.
You kind of went high to medium to, like, abyss.
Yes,
right there.
No, and that's kind of how the reviews in general went. They... those that hit the highs were hitting a lot of what I took away from the film, that battle between man and machine and right and wrong and where we sit in the world. And or they just flat out hated it, but they don't give a whole lot of meat to why. Like, calling it trashy and dumb, what are you hanging your hat on that?
Yeah, no, exactly. I read
the whole article. He didn't actually have anything to hang his hat on.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it dumb or trashy.
No.
Yeah, I didn't love it.
No,
but it was fine. It was decent. It was well made, you know. And yeah, it asks a few questions, you know, and definitely in the questions that they were asking in 2014 might be even more relevant in 2024.
I'm actually running a bit of an experiment myself. Like I said, I had my son watch this one with me. And I have to get over, interestingly enough, this is the PG-13 one. The original is a hard R.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm trying to get over whether or not I'm ready for him to see the R. I might have to do a quick rewatch to find out what. Mm-hmm. I know the violence was dialed up. And I believe there was a touch of nudity, at least in the TV program or something like that. I'd buy that for a dollar guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I may do a quick rewatch, and then I want him to see the original, and I just kind of want to get his impression on whether or not, he's seen this one, and he actually kind of liked this. He actually liked it rather quite a bit, and he's a 14-year-old boy. What's not to like? It's a guy that's been turned into a robot, but he seemed to enjoy it. I'd like to see his impression on the older, campier thing and see what that does for him. Now, at 14, that's a different story.
I would predict, just having seen what my own son has liked and not liked of the things I've shown him, I would predict that the 87 is going to fall pretty flat for him.
Possibly. And it's, you're not from that time, but I almost wish there were a way, much like you, but you already saw the 87 RoboCop. So seeing this new for the first time, I still sit in this space in my head where if the 87 RoboCop had never existed, I wonder if that would elevate this one a little bit more.
Right. Would this make this the best RoboCop
film? So I'd like
film.
To take somebody right. around our age who may have never actually managed to see the original RoboCop and then show them in that order and see what their impressions are, because I think it does elevate the topic of RoboCop, but it is a way different film than the original.
Oh, so. Absolutely. I mean, the first one was definitely very 80s.
It's very 80s. But, and, I mean, it was made in the 80s. It's got to be 80s.
And maybe, you know, maybe this one is very 20-teens.
Yes.
I mean, that's something that we'll probably become more aware of as we progress into the 21st century. You know, when we're watching films in 2030, will we look back in films that were made 20, 30, 40 years ago and go, oh, yes, that was really 2000s.
Yeah. And it's hard not to see it in that light, but the social experiment of stuff like this, just it really kind of fascinates me.
Yeah, very much. All right, well, I think that is going to do it for RoboCop 2014. We didn't actually discuss what we were going to do next time.
No, so I guess that's going to have to be a surprise.
That will be a surprise.
For us as well.
We'll discuss that off mic. If you've seen RoboCop 2014 and like to drop your thoughts, please send an email to timeshifterspodcast@gmail.com. Follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites. Come join our Discord server. You'll find the link there in the show notes as well. But that is going to do it for this one. Thanks very much for listening, Tom. Thanks as always.
Happy to be here in studio for this one.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to. It's a pleasure to have you. It's so rare that I have someone else in studio, so it's a lot of fun.
It adds a dynamic when you can actually see each other other than through a webcam.
Yep, absolutely. All right, that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
See ya.